Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I will be your host for the next hour. The music you are listening to is the brother and sister duo from Nicaragua called Guarda Barranco. Dale en Luz is the song, or Shine a Light. We are now knee-deep in our end-of-year campaign with the goal of raising $75,000 to support the community radio shows you love. At a time when our progressive and inclusive activist space is under the greatest threat in our 56-year history, we call on you, our listeners, to support us to whatever degree you are able. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by clicking the red box Donate in the mobile app, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by mailing a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. We devote much of our show today to a look back at the local Central America solidarity movement here in Portland during the 1980s, not out of nostalgia, but to inform us about our present-day political challenges. We bring together three veteran activists from that movement to talk about the successes we had and what lessons they hold for us as we confront rising assaults on our civil rights, democracy, and peace. We begin our show with the left and the law. Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discuss the largest and arguably most far-reaching case in history being heard right now before the International Court of Justice. It was brought by Pacific Islander law students seeking redress for the existential peril Pacific Islanders face due to climate change. Here's Jan and Mike.
The top United Nations court, the International Court of Justice, took up the largest case in its history beginning on December 2nd, hearing the arguments of representatives of Vanuatu and other Pacific Island nations who've been testifying about climate change and how it's threatening their very survival. They demand that major polluting nations be held to account. This case before the ICJ was initiated by a group of Pacific Island law students in 2019 who have persisted with this ambitious undertaking. So hats off to them. Mike, let's talk about the timing of this case too, just 3 weeks after the disappointing outcome at the United Nations COP29 annual conference of parties that did not fulfill the ambitions many brought to it in terms of commitments to address the effects of climate change and the unequal effects worldwide of climate change. Do you want to say anything about how this Court of Justice case differs from these annual COP conferences?
Well, the Conference of Parties was held this year in one of the major oil-producing countries, the city of Baku. And it had the virtue of talking about money at great length. Who owes it? Who is a developed nation? How much is owed for what's happened in the past? To what extent are we custodians for the future? And who's going to pay for it? You know, how about China, which is polluting more than anybody except possibly the US, but it has four times as many people as the US and is creating more than half the world's alternate sources of energy. A lot of sharp questions got asked. The answer was of commitments, which are pretty dubious, of $300 billion, which was a small fraction of the $1.3 trillion that people generally recognized would be necessary to make up for damage done in recent years. But that was all, it was very realpolitik. This is a different animal, this International Court of Justice. What I think it will do.
Before you explain what it will do, can you say a bit about the International Court of Justice, how it differs from the International Criminal Court? We've been covering ICJ and the International Criminal Court quite a bit this past year around Israel. Say a little about what the court, how it's constituted, and what it does.
Well, the ICJ is the main judicial organ of the United Nations, and it's concerned with states. It's not to be confused with the ICC, which prosecutes individuals. It was the ICC that issued warrants for the arrest of Benjamin Netanyahu and officials in Israel and Hamas. But the ICJ issues advisory opinions. They're not really binding on anybody, but they're terrific instruments of preventive diplomacy and ways of articulating and highlighting real problems. The Israel opinion that they issued was based on top-notch briefing done by South Africa, really thorough articulation of the last 80 years of history in Israel with extremely well-organized briefing, both for and against their charges, and it led to stories in every country in the world, and that we can expect the same to emerge from the hearings. They're taking statements from 98 different countries. It is the biggest case they've ever taken, just in terms of volume of participants. And they will issue an advisory opinion on the obligation of states sometime this summer, probably. But they'll deal with questions like, what legal obligations does a state have to fight climate change? Should high-emitting countries be held responsible for the harm they've done in the past? And what is the obligation of a state to safeguard the climate for future generations? They'll issue detailed opinions on these fundamental questions.
Yeah, it's always interested me, that aspect of courts with all their limitations and the inequities built into the very structure of legal systems, including ours. But you have to have a good argument, and evidence does matter in courts. And so I was wondering your sense of the difference between the kind of proceedings that unfold every year with their massive number of oil lobbyists that outnumber activists now at COP every year. But it's not just the moral weight of an argument, but how or how they're enforced, but what kinds of evidence and the kind of discourse that can take center stage at the International Court of Justice that gets marginalized or sidelined at many of these, like the Paris Accord, all the way, the whole history of these annual conferences are impressive, but there's a lot of rhetoric too.
Yeah, the UN is relatively free from the immediate interests that are both the strength and the weakness of these COP conferences. As you point out, they're now dominated by oil companies and businesses whose livelihood and whose flourishing in the future, in their mind, depends on continuing to do things that change the climate. So the UN is not so interest driven here. They really can focus on the issue. That's one of the great strengths of the UN, that it's designed to do that, and that every now and then that's exactly what it does. So this hearings will be take place from December 2nd to December 13th. Many of them have already happened, but they contain testimony from all kinds of scientists talking about the ocean, the air, the land, all kinds of people who are directly affected by climate change. There'll be a wide range of witnesses. It'll be very abstract, very intellectual, very mathematical. It'll also be very gritty. So it'll be down in the mud, literally. And there'll be testimony from people who live in places that are in danger of disappearing completely. And they will have this wide array of testimony, of documents, of evidence to consider. And they've got smart people, and they'll write something that will be, I think, the subject of a lot of contention, discussion. It'll be embraced. It'll be quasi-embraced. It will be a touchstone in this ongoing debate.
And cited by many climate activists around the world. I wanted to add, too, that you can go on the United Nations website for these specific hearings and watch them. So after they're recorded, you can watch this testimony, and it's fascinating. And over the course of the ICJ hearings on South Africa's case against Israel, I watched many of the proceedings, and they're gripping in their own way. There's a kind of formality and a kind of democratic tone to them, where you have the U.S. have their same number of minutes, like on December 5th, a representative of the United States did not disparage the proceedings, but said, we really think we should rely on diplomacy for this and not institute any new agreements or requirements. That typical response, I'm sure, after Trump comes into office, it'll be a different kind of response. With the representatives for the U.S. at this month, it was kind of a typical Democratic Party response. It's like, well, it's an existential threat. It's a very big threat, and we're working on it, but not very hard.
Yeah, well, it's what's happening, and it's really the only thing we can do over the next 4 years is to litigate in terms of working with the system and within the system, because the executive branch of government is not going to be a source of anything good. The legislative branch of government is pretty gone, but forum shopping will take place. Just as Trump beat himself down to Lubbock, Texas to file lawsuits, people will go to San Francisco, California to file lawsuits. They'll find judges. And one thing that the Biden administration did that was admirable was appoint a lot of good judges. The Supreme Court justice, Ketanji Brown, is the best justice has been in quite a while. Very articulate, forceful, with great values.
There are a lot Even of in issuing minority opinions.
Yeah, exactly. But they are articulated. They're there. They are read and can be read. And she's holding up the flag. So people will be able to go to court, and they are going to court about the climate. The Sabin Institute for Climate Change at Columbia University keeps track of all the litigation, all the constitutional litigation, all the statutory litigation, litigation in this country, litigation around the world, and there are now hundreds of lawsuits of every sort. Lawsuits are now being filed by the other side as well, limiting opinions, trying to limit expression. But lawsuits are being filed by state tort remedies about all the damages done to people. People are being able to articulate now directly how they've been hurt. So a lot of the initial legal hurdles of standing and all the procedural stuff has taken up years, but there will be cases that will be in the news. There will be testimony taken on climate changes cases over the next few years.
So getting back to your point on Trump and the International Court of Justice, to the extent that this will be like other international agreements, something that the Trump administration, the Republicans, will either ignore or disparage and express tremendous disdain, do you have a sense of where that leaves legal arguments from other countries or the legal ground to the extent that the U.S. doesn't participate in this?
Well, there's no enforcement mechanism. So it's not going to be enforced. There's no army at the UN's disposal. They can't order Exxon not to further explore in the jungle. So the Trump will disparage it, but that's all they can do. And people who think whatever Trump disparages should be disparaged will continue to think that, but nobody else will. There is always a margin of people who will be persuaded if the argument is articulated in a clear way with convincing evidence in support of it. I mean, as you said, there's nothing quite so persuasive as something that's is grounded in facts that you can show and connect it up with results and consequences. And people will be using all the arts of persuasion in these
Including
little.
these moving stories from the Pacific Islanders and elsewhere, where they're literally submerged by the oceans engulfing them. And so there's gripping storytelling and experiential knowledge and science grounded in indigenous ways of being close to the earth and what's happening in the world, and moral arguments about a responsibility to live in a different relationship with the natural world around us. So I find these settings are really important. And of course, there's also then the question of how social movements participate in them. And perhaps you could say a bit about that before we stop today, where you were saying a lot of what we have now ahead is fighting through the courts internationally and domestically, but that can take a lot of expertise. There's a lot of minutiae around the law. What's your take on the role of these court cases as they relate to movements of and fighting back against this very right-wing reactionary government that we're now living under soon?
We have to use the tools at hand. And there will be a trial of Luigi. That will be a big trial. There will be ecological trials. And trials have always been in the news. It's true, they're clogged with minutiae, and nobody would want to sit and watch all 8 hours of a day's court proceedings.
Speak for yourself. Fascinating.
But there are excerpts from every day that are
That's
worth.
right.
There are contexts to fit it in. There's differing views, and there will be. We've seen court cases just swallow entirely the whole media, like with the O.J. Simpson case. And there will be climate change proceedings, I think, where money will be on the line and people will be galvanized by persuasive arguments and by poignant anecdotes and by scientific proof. These usual things that persuade people, that have persuaded people for millennia. And like I said, I don't see any other, there will be the streets, which always lay beneath or foundational to movements and changes, will be
And
people
what
that,
can happen in the courts? Yeah.
and they shape what judges think, they shape how everybody thinks and feels. It will be the presence or absence of social movements and demonstrations. And I think the forum where we will be able to embody that and move forward with that will be the courts. That's all we got.
Yeah. So in the months to come, in the new year, we'll be following the courts and the way that social movements can advance through the courts, and using whatever creative tools that we have. Any words of wisdom or encouragement you want to make as we close for today? You're pretty enthusiastic about the promise of the courts locally and internationally.
Well, it's not so much enthusiasm. I would prefer a House of Representatives that would make a really good budget, but we don't have that. And we don't have any president who's going to do anything that we like. He's going to be very militaristic. He might randomly do things like limiting a combat here that we like, but he will exacerbate combat over there. But I think basically, in terms of what can be done with the existing institutions, the courts are where the only place where we have a play, the only place where we can move ahead. And I think we should use them. There are forums around this country that are receptive to the arguments you and I would like to make. We should find them.
And we'll be following that work in the courts and on the streets. Thanks, Mike. Have a good holiday, however you choose to celebrate.
As the sun gets hotter.
The music you just heard, The Islands Are Calling, was produced by Pacific Islands Students Fighting Climate Change, written and sung by Camilla, rapper Odd 18, and artist Kazeem. Before that, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker were talking about the climate justice case currently being heard at the International Court of Justice. You are listening to KBOO Portland. The Old Mole Collective has hosted one of the longest-lived shows on KBOO. We've brought on to our show hundreds of local activists involved in a huge diversity of progressive projects to talk about their work. We're part of the glue that unites our community. Please support our show and KBOO. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by clicking the red box Donate in the mobile app, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by mailing a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. In their segment, Jan and Mike talked about how social justice movements shape the views of the public on climate and other issues, and how this can impact legal judgments as well, including cases as critical as the one now before the ICJ. For the remainder of our show, we're going to talk about how to build movements, drawing on the successes of the Central America Solidarity Movement of the 1980s. Here I am speaking with three veterans of that movement. In 1979, the armed revolutionary forces of the Sandinistas overthrew the brutal and dictatorial regime of Anastasio Somoza in Nicaragua. At that time, in the neighboring countries of Guatemala and El Salvador, there were also armed revolutionary groups operating. Needless to say, among the political and military elites in this country, those developments were quite alarming. And Ronald Reagan, in particular, who was elected president in 1980, was very determined to maintain U.S. hegemony in the area. But the American public had very little appetite for further overseas military adventures. The war in Vietnam had recently come to a close, and thanks in large part to a robust and effective anti-war movement. So when activists saw that there might be another Vietnam brewing in Central America, solidarity movements began to spring up all over the country to counter that possibility. And that broad-based Central America solidarity movement can be credited with blunting the U.S. military intervention that did happen in the region, with opening up space for revolutionary groups in the region to pursue their projects, and also for hardening the stateside public opposition to the imperial aspirations of this country. In Portland, there was a very large and vibrant solidarity movement. And today I have with me three activists who were veterans of that movement to talk about what we might learn from that movement. As activists today, we face a situation that is in some ways very different, but in other ways not. So I have with me today Millie Thayer, who was a staff person for PCASC, a Portland-Sorrento sister city liaison, and a movement journalist in Nicaragua. Diane Hess also worked with PCASC, American Friends Service Committee, and the Portland-Sorrento Sister City Association. Gideon Hughes started organizing around Central America as a student at Lewis and Clark College, and later was active in PCASC. He was on the first Ben Linder Construction Brigade to Nicaragua. So welcome, everybody, to KPOO and to the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Great to be here.
Yeah, thanks.
Fantastic.
Diane, I think I want to start with you. Could you describe for our listeners a little bit about PCASC and how you approached your work and what similarities you see with the political landscape of today?
Sure. First of all, I should say PCASC was one of many organizations in Portland and around the state dealing with intervention in Central America and solidarity work. I would say we were the center of the wheel that had a lot of spokes on it. We were, had the largest capacity, but there were groups of, labor people, medical people, lawyers, campus groups like the ones Gideon was in, a range of other organizations, especially those tied to religious communities. And also there were groups around the state that we stayed in touch with. So there was a lot going on. And our focus was really, first of all, to get the word out. A lot of people did not know what was happening in Central America. So there was a lot of outreach and education through speakers that came up from Central America, people from here who went down and learned about it. We went to churches, community groups, service organizations, schools, and so on. Really got the message out and then worked at mobilizing folks in a variety of ways to impact public policy and try to stop U.S. intervention. And as you said, Patsy, we were not successful in totally stopping intervention and influencing Central America, although there were not boots on the ground. There was not, in essence, another Vietnam.
So what were some of the ways that you work to mobilize people, to engage them in the movement?
Well, there were a lot of different elements here of involving people. One was, of course, to try to influence policymakers, whether it was just like we do today through petitions. Of course, we didn't have email and texting them, but to try to pressure our senators, our Congress people to take a stand and change U.S. policy. We did this in a variety of ways, from petitions, letter writing, and so on, out to, sitting in at their offices, having direct actions, rallies, civil disobedience, and so on. One of the things we did around this that I think was really an important model is something we called the Pledge of Resistance, where we weren't waiting for something horrendous to be done by the government, but we wanted to be prepared in advance. And so we reached out to a variety of constituencies, and this was happening throughout the country. If the U.S. government invades, if they do this, I will do that. I am prepared to do civil disobedience, go out in the streets. So at the time something happens, some kind of crisis, we're not all running around thinking, what are we going to do? We're ready to go. And I'll just make another point right now, which is that a lot of what we did, besides directly contacting folks at the federal level, was looking at citizen diplomacy locally, how we could involve the state legislature, our local governments, our universities, resolutions, a ballot measure, forming a sister city with a city in Nicaragua, to have ways that local and state governments could pressure the federal government, ways to activate a lot of folks and potentially have at least a small success as part of that process. And in the sister city model, established people-to-people relationships as well, which helped move the movement forward.
I could give an example of that. One of the things that we did was we brought a delegation of two high school students and their high school principal from Corinto, Nicaragua. And they came to Portland. They went to high schools. They went to Lincoln. I think it was Lincoln and Jefferson. They gave talks and classes about what life was like in Nicaragua under the Sandinista government. And they had exchanges with students in classrooms. You know, that was a very direct kind of people-to-people experience.
What strikes me about what you've both been saying is that the movement engaged in a whole variety of tactics to counter the push for military intervention in the region, but also that people could be involved at many, many different levels, could make different kinds of commitments to being involved. I'm interrupting our conversation to mention KBOO's current membership drive. Making connections is what KBOO is all about, bringing together on the airwaves a broad collection of music and conversation and activism from all corners of our community. If you are able, please help us reach our year-end goal of raising $75,000. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by clicking the red box Donate in the mobile app, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by mailing a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Now, back to our discussion of movement building. I want to hear a little bit from Gideon, because he was involved a bit in direct action in a very interesting way. And I particularly would like to hear from you, Gideon, a little bit about FLIR, who they were and why you chose that particular company to organize against.
Well, late in 1986, I was working with PCAST and we heard about this company that was located in Hillsboro called FLIR. It stood for Forward Looking Infrared. And they developed this technology that was for rescuing people lost on mountains like Mount Hood. But we had heard that they were making a concerted effort to sell this equipment to the Salvadoran military. And the military, the Duarte government, was using this equipment, mounting it on helicopters and directing machine gun fire and often killing citizens in the liberated zones. Once we heard of this, we figured we got to do something. Friends of ours, Chuck Bell and Will Singer, decided to go dumpster diving one night and came back with the mother load of information. They emptied some big garbage bags, sorted the coffee grounds away from the paperwork, and discovered business models and blueprints, all suggesting that selling to the Salvadoran military was a big part of their plan. Reinforced with this information, we went and met with them and asked them to remind themselves that they initially developed this technology for helping people and rescuing people, not to sell to the Salvadoran military. That didn't go very far. We then decided we were going to stage a civil disobedience action and occupy their office and at least shut down business for a day. And 39 of us took civil disobedience training and were prepared to be arrested. But leading up to the event, we realized we had lots of supporters. There were about 300 or 400 that were going to be there. We wanted to create a little bit more of a media event. So several of us built a small helicopter that was very lightweight. It was about the size of a car, and it could be hoisted by four different people on each corner. And it could be sort of maneuvered as though it were flying. And we built a FLIR-looking object on the front of it. We had Duarte, the president of El Salvador, in one seat of the helicopter and Reagan in the other. and we staged a mock machine gun fire of civilians. And we did get some good press out of the deal. But the day of the event, the night before, FLIR had erected an 8-foot fence around their entire building, something that we had not prepared for. On one side was those of us who were going to be arrested and try to get over the fence. And on the other side was a private security firm, as well as the police. And I remember at the last minute, you know, coming up to one of the people that were going to try to occupy the FLIR office. Her name was Martina Curl. She was 82 years old. I said, "Martina, you know, that's an 8-foot fence. What are you going to do?" And he goes, "With your help, I think I can get to the top. And I hope that those nice policemen won't let me fall on the other side." And I said, I hope you're right. As it turns out, that went on without a hitch. And 39 of us were arrested that day and subsequently went to trial. We ended up not having to pay fines or do any community service. And we got to go right back to doing the work that with PCAST that we'd always been doing.
If I can just add a couple of points about FLIR. One is those types of actions made what was happening so far away in Central America real to people here in the local area. And the other thing about FLIR was it was here in the Portland metropolitan area. So was Evergreen Helicopters that was working with the CIA to do horrible things in El Salvador. These all gave local hooks to something that could feel so far away and distant, not only the distance of Central America, but just federal policy in general.
And to dovetail on that, Ben Linder, who was assassinated by the Contra for trying to establish some electricity in a small village in Nicaragua. He was a Portland native, and again, a local angle that helped fuel lots and lots of good work, and ended up 7 construction brigades were sent to Portland's sister city as a result to pay homage to Ben.
Millie, I'd like to hear a little more from you. Maybe you can speak to what you thought the particular strengths of this movement were.
I would say there were 3 of them. Diane already mentioned one, which was the local angle. And I wanted to just, as I mentioned each one, I want to talk a little bit about the contemporary situation. Actually, the Palestine Solidarity Movement here where I live in Massachusetts has targeted a company. It's called L3 Harris, and it's one of the biggest military providers of equipment to Israel. So, you know, they've targeted it, and there have already been several civil disobediences there. So that's a tactic that, you know, activists today have definitely picked up on. So as far as other strengths of the movement, I think the fact that so many people were able to see for themselves what was happening in Nicaragua and also in El Salvador. I know Gideon went on a trip to El Salvador and Guatemala, and that was an instant education for people who, as Patsy said, you know, had very little knowledge of the region. They came home and they gave talks to their church or their school, and it helped them build long-term commitments to the movement, which is, you know, I think a partial explanation of why the movement lasted 10 or 15 years. I mean, that's extraordinary for this kind of movement. And today, obviously, travel to Palestine, if we're going to use that movement as a comparison, is much more challenging than it was for us to go to Central America. You know, it's something to really think about for movements today. Perhaps they need to connect more with the diaspora of Palestinians in this country and through speakers who can talk about the impact of the war on their own families, you know, historically and also in Gaza today. That's one thing. I think probably our greatest strength really was the community that we built through many of the things that Diane talked about. I mean, we spent a lot of time in endless meetings, in retreats, in potlucks, building helicopters, getting arrested, sitting on bridges, knocking on doors together. Just the activity produced a lot of bonds between people. And also the fact that some of it was risky, or even if it wasn't a life and death risk, for many people, it was a steep learning curve. You know, these were new things they were being asked to do or asking of themselves. So it was really a space of for learning and growth as a person, as well as in terms of your understanding of politics and international relations and all those kinds of things.
Well, wasn't a big part of the project creating a different narrative? That it's not just a bunch of commies down there that are going to destroy our way of life here in the U.S.? I mean, wasn't that a big part of it as well, to talk about what it means to be a revolutionary, or how does that change a country? Or
yes, and also to learn how to share that message with other people. So members of the, you know, of PCASC and the other groups, they had to often be in the position of explaining to someone else. Maybe they knocked on their door to ask for their signature. So to talk to them about what kind of societies are being built, you know, in Nicaragua or in the liberated zones of El Salvador.
If I may, it was also a really unique time because, you know, the revolution that was in Nicaragua had happened. And we were supporting something that was taking place. And what was going on in El Salvador, they were, you know, aspiring to some of those same things. So the two happening simultaneously, we were able to sort of capture a certain kind of energy that, you know, really was very sustaining. And yet we could, you know, bounce back and forth between issues and really reach people even when they, you know, were a little more skeptical than we might want.
Well, I remember it as being a very exciting time. What was going on down there was very inspirational.
You know, there's a couple of issues right now that are at the front among many. One of them, Millie mentioned, you know, what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank and in Palestine. Another one where I think there's a lot of things that connect is what's going to happen with migrants in this country. And I mentioned the Pledge of Resistance earlier. I mean, we probably need to get ready now because they're going to come after people. What are we going to do to prepare for that? Another aspect of the movement was the sanctuary movement. There was quite a number of congregations that got together to help protect people who were in danger, so they weren't sent back to Central America. You know, there's a long history of churches being safe places. And I would want to see congregations perhaps taking that role on again. One other thought in terms of the movement today, I mean, one thing we could have learned from them, but we couldn't have because we didn't have the technology, is now, of course, that there's the capacity to reach so many more people with texts and emails and so on. The capacity was mind-boggling because we were tied down to bulk mailings and phone calls. But those kinds of things help to build person-to-person relationships, having conversations with people. I know I get so many emails on so many causes and so many texts, it's kind of a different thing. And even the bulk mailings, there were groups of us together talking about politics and political strategies as we put those together. And that all fed into what Millie was talking about, more meetings, more in-person gatherings, you know, going out for beers afterwards too, but just really building those human connections, because in difficult times you depend on each other and support each other. So obviously we're in a different time period, but I think it might make sense for activists today to say, well, what are ways we can increase that human connection to help really build the movement?
I'd like to add, I was part of a phone tree. and I had 20 people that were on my list. You know, I didn't reach out and, you know, talk about the weather. When I called them, there was something going down that needed to be discussed. And what's great about the phone is it's just you and another person. And you took the time to make sure that the message was conveyed. They asked questions. There was a back and forth. And it personalized it. Sometimes it was really hard starting the phone, go, oh my God, I've got to talk to 20 people tonight. But we knew each other. It works really, really well, but I don't know if it would work today.
Well, I am going to add to something that Gideon just said when he said we knew each other. One of the problems today with doing phoning is people don't answer the phone. They look and see who it is.
Right.
But if there's an ongoing relationship and someone looks at their phone and it says Gideon Hughes, as mm-hmm. opposed to potential spam or something else,
yeah.
they're more likely to actually answer even today because that relationship has been established.
It sounds like there was a depth of organizing and a depth of relationships that many modern movements have been criticized for not making. Millie, were you going to add something to that?
Yeah, I was thinking about your question of what do I wish we had done differently? And it's actually, it also relates to what Gideon and Diane have been saying. And that is, in building the community, we always had relationships with people working on other issues in the 80s. You know, we would attend each other's events, they would speak at our rallies. But I think the connections between the issues, we didn't do very much joint organizing. It's something actually I'm seeing now in the face of the results of the elections. Around here, and I bet all over the country, people are gathering. We had a meeting on Sunday where people from many different walks of life, different, you know, activists from different issues. The question was, what now? So one woman said, she was a labor organizer. She said, I think we need to start walking towards each other. And to me, that is partly what Diane and Gideon are saying about personal bonds, but it's also about how do our issues complement each other? How, you know, what is the relationship between targeted groups like trans people and immigrants? What about the relationship between Palestine and, you know, Central America? And I think it's an opportunity for us. It's not that we would have chosen it, but it's a time when we might be able to really build a much broader analysis and critique of the kind of society we live in. And I guess the other thing I want to say is that we don't have Nicaragua anymore in the same form that we had it back in the day. So we need to find hope in some other places. And one of the places I'm finding it is in these kinds of gatherings of people, the sharing, the vulnerability, the, you know, I was kind of worried somebody would start pontificating about what the, you know, answer to all our problems was. But no, it was people trying to think out loud together. It really gave me hope to be there. And I guess that's where I'm going to be looking for inspiration.
Well, and maybe that's also one way we should gauge our success is in those connections that are made, because we're not going to be able to have the kind of material success that we would really like. But building a movement seems to me to be a key goal, and how that is done is through exactly what I think all three of you have been talking about, making those phone calls, being in that meeting, being vulnerable to each other, trying to understand each other's issues and drawing those links. Anyone want to comment further on that?
I do have a thought, and I don't necessarily have an answer for it, but maybe other folks do. I have been talking to a number of activists or people who were activists in the past who are very afraid now to take action more than they were then. And certainly back then, we were always thinking, oh, is the FBI infiltrating our meetings? Are we safe? But, you know, all of this talk about the new administration potentially sending out the military or going after people, there is, you know, I think at this moment, nervousness among many people about how that's going to unfold. And I think that is something we have to think about, is potential personal risk, because it may be a little bit different than it was in the 80s.
I was in a webinar the other day where somebody acknowledged what you're saying, Diane, that there are, you know, we don't know yet really what the threats are going to be, but there is this feeling of anxiety about it. And so, you know, they said, well, first of all, we have to have each other's backs. We have to be prepared to stand up for other people who are being targeted. It's probably not going to be us middle class white people necessarily first in line, but so that was one thing. And then he had us go around, had everyone go around and say, if you're afraid, what makes you feel brave? And it was a pretty big group, so you know, people had lots of answers, but they were interesting. It's like, I think of my ancestors and what they had to go through, or I think of, you know, a really inspiring trans activist and what he or she has had to risk. And, you know, or I think of something I did when I was a kid, when I stood up for somebody else. But I think it's something we can't solve individually. You know, it has to be a collective process. It is really scary to be alone in your house thinking, oh my God, they're coming after me.
We're going to need to bring this to a close pretty soon here. Do you have any other reflections on the successes or perhaps on the failures of the local solidarity movement that are useful to think about as we approach these pretty perilous times?
Well, I'll start with some successes that we had. We reached a hell of a lot of people. I mean, one thing I think about is when we did the local ballot measure on El Salvador, we went door to door. That movement was very different in from the Palestine movement today, in that a lot of people had no idea where El Salvador was or had never heard anything. So a lot of the times we had very fertile ground. We weren't dealing with any assumptions they already had. But that's just one example of, on the positive side, is that we really reached a lot of folks, raised a lot of awareness, which hopefully stuck with them after that era in terms of being suspicious about U.S. foreign policy, which hopefully had some lasting impact.
Something that I'd like to mention, and maybe it's just a word that keeps coming up in my own mind, is momentum. We always had something to go on, whether we got done with, you know, the biggest demonstration we ever pulled off, there was always letter writing or something else afterwards. And a lot of times it wasn't nearly as exciting as the demonstrations, but it was a chance for people in a smaller group to ask questions that they've been having, to get to educate themselves a little better so that they could reach out to their coworkers or to their fellow students or whatever. I don't think we ever planned to just always have things endlessly to go on, but that's what it felt like at the time. And the result was, is that we could always plug people in. If you weren't ready to take on the Pledge of Resistance, would you help us come lick some stamps at something else? And the other thing is, we ate a lot of pizza. We made things fun. And it is hard when these are difficult issues, these are difficult times, but to remember that, you know, we got to dance sometimes. And we did our share, and it was fun to do it with people that we, you know, had been having all these hard conversations with and about for a while.
Millie, last word before we close.
Yeah, I've been inspired by the students at the university where I teach or taught. They have really built their own community in exciting ways. You know, they use very horizontal forms of democracy. There's a lot of mutual aid and accountability, and they are facing a lot of fear. So I think it has helped them create bonds between each other. And I think the real danger of repression and the kind of fear that Diane was talking about is that it can interrupt the possibility of community because, you know, it sort of shuts down the spaces where people come together. I think that's something we have to be really aware of, because if they succeed in doing that, then they've won. So we really need to defend our spaces, our ability to speak out, to protest. Thinking about the present, that's what I would say.
Well, this has been a really rich discussion. I'm very grateful to all three of you for agreeing to come on. And I'm Patricia Kohlberg. I've been talking this morning with Millie Thayer, with Gideon Hughes, and Diane Hess, who are all four of us actually veterans of the Portland Central America Solidarity Movement of the 1980s. So thank you very much for coming on this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jóvenes manos combatientes, fundidas al metal con que nos salvas. Te cambió este amar la vida y sus promesas por el frío de tus pies entre los guampos, fragua donde se te quema el miedo y la nostalgia. Autor anónimo de la alborada.
You just heard another clip from Guarda Barranco, a song called Guerrero del Amor, or Warrior of Love. And that's a wrap for our show today. I want to thank Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker for their Left in the Law segment, and a special thanks to our guests today, Diane Hess, Gideon Hughes, and Millie Thayer. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host this morning. It's imperative during these uniquely perilous times that our community comes together to support each other and resist the rise of the extreme right wing. One way to help is to support The Old Mole, which brings you views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up, a perspective that you will not hear on commercial radio. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by clicking the red box Donate in the mobile app, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by mailing a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. I'm going to sign off today with more of that music from the Pacific Islands Students Fighting Climate Change called The Islands Are Calling. Thanks for listening.
Time is slipping like sands from my head.